Thanks everyone for joining. I'm Tilly, I'm a member of Solidarity and I'll be chairing this afternoon's session. I want to start by acknowledging that almost all of us, I'd say, are Zooming in from Aboriginal land. I'm personally Zooming in from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. As Solidarity, we want to pay our respects to elders both past and present, and to, you know, acknowledge that the fight continues for Aboriginal self-determination and land rights and all many other struggles. Thanks for coming to this second session of Resist and Rebel. This is a conference that's hosted by Solidarity. We're a revolutionary socialist organization. We're active in many, many fights for building a better world. And the struggle that we're talking about in this session is very much one of those. So this afternoon, we're talking about Palestinian resistance, revolution, and the Middle East. We have two speakers. We're very lucky to be joined by Anthony Lowenstein, who's an independent journalist, an author, a filmmaker, and was based in East Jerusalem from 2016 to 2020. And he's also writing a new book on how the Israeli occupation has gone global, which is going to be out in 2023. And then we're going to hear from Caitlin Doyle, who's a member of Solidarity. She's also a refugee activist, a climate activist, and a member of the MEAA, which is the Union for Media, Arts and Entertainment. So we'll have some short time for discussion after that. I'll just let everyone know up front that this session is being live streamed on Facebook. So just in case you want to, you don't want to have your camera on. And to start us off, I will hand over to Anthony Lowenstein.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for having me today. I know that initially when I was asked it was going to be in person, and wouldn't that have been nice? But here we are. And I'm really glad to talk about this issue today. I'll speak for about 15 or so minutes, and then Caitlin's going to, we had a little chat before, so we're not going to be covering the same issues. That's the theory anyway. I wanted to talk to you guys a little bit today about a few things. One, a little bit about my experiences on the ground over there in Palestine. As was just said by Tilly, I was based there between 2016 and 2020, but I've been visiting there for over 15 years, Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, and elsewhere. And much of the Middle East, actually, but I know today's focus is Palestine. A little bit about the growing, what I see, public Palestinian resistance to both Israeli occupation, and I would argue the Palestinian occupation. What I mean by that is a Palestinian Authority, which arguably is also occupying Palestine with US and Israeli backing. And I'd also like to talk a little bit about the situation in Gaza and about the reality between Israel has a new prime minister, which has not been the case for over 12 years. And I think it's worth talking a little bit about what that means, if anything, for a change between Israel and the US and how that impacts us here in Australia. So I was based in East Jerusalem in Sheikh Jarrah for 4 years between 2016 and 2020. And the reason I wanted to start off by talking about that was many of you, of course, in this conversation are going to be very well aware of what's been happening there really for decades, or particularly in the last 6 to 12 months, which is the forced removal of a lot of Palestinian families from that area. And I lived down the road when I was living there from this exact area. It was within Sheikh Jarrah, and I was living with a Palestinian family there. For those who don't know, Sheikh Jarrah is a predominantly Palestinian area. There are growing numbers of Jewish settlers that are moving in there, usually forcibly allowed to move in there, kick out Palestinians who have been living there for decades. And when I was there in 2009, I very clearly remember visiting a home of a Palestinian family who were literally being kicked out as I was there. They were sitting, it was the middle of summer there, so I think it was about August, so the Northern Hemisphere summer. And they were sitting on a couch, literally sitting on a couch outside their home as Jewish settlers were allowed to move in there. And they had nowhere to go. And I walked past that house constantly when I lived there between 2016 and 2020. I never went in there because it wasn't possible. Essentially, the place had surveillance cameras everywhere. It was very much controlled by the settlers who still live there. And what's been happening since 2009, it's been going on for a long time, it's escalated in the last, I'd say, particularly 6-12 months, is the increased forcible removal of Palestinian families. Many of you will be aware of that. That was one of the sparks of the recent Gaza conflict between Hamas and Israel. And one of the, I guess, remarkable things about that, apart from the fact that there is, with some exceptions, a lot of international silence around what's happening in Sheikh Jarrah, is actually a growing awareness, I think, in many countries around the world, and indeed amongst Palestinians, both in the West Bank and Gaza, politically, of how important it is to resist that. Now, that's been the case for 50 years, of course, but I think it's changed in the last while. Let me briefly explain why. It's changed because there's a growing, I think, awareness of two things. One, a greater ability and maybe slight openness internationally to what's happening there. There's no doubt there is still an overwhelming support for Israel and the international community. I say that across much of the world, the Arab countries, which I'll get to. When I say the Arab countries, I mean the Arab leadership, of course, not the Arab people. The US, although there are shifts happening there, much of Europe, again, I'm talking more about the leadership than I am about Europeans as a people. But overall, I would say Israel gets away with what it does because there's virtually no punishment or ramifications for doing so. But what I think has happened is the court of public opinion is important. And I think what you've seen in the last 6 or 12 months, particularly, is a huge growing awareness amongst many Palestinians, particularly young Palestinians who are in their 20s, living in Sheikh Jarrah, West Bank and Gaza and elsewhere, of being able to connect with an international community and an audience that was not possible before. So, for example, in the last 6 months, many of you will have seen a lot of prominent Palestinian activists in Sheikh Jarrah, some of whose homes were possibly going to be removed from them, speaking on mainstream American television. Now, that doesn't mean policy changes. I'm not naive enough to believe that simply appearing on MSNBC means that the occupation ends. Of course not. But I think it's significant. And it's significant because it shows that there is a small but growing opening and audience to this kind of message, namely that the occupation is now 53 years old. It's arguably permanent. And therefore, there needs to be different tactics to address that. So, one thing that was really striking when I was living there for many years was how I would see virtually every day, and I'm Jewish, I mean, I'm anti-Zionist, but I'm Jewish. So there was no racism directed at me, but there was profound Jewish racism directed against Palestinians. And I saw this virtually every day I was there in the form of Israeli police harassing Palestinians literally down the road from my house. I saw it all the time. Their cars being stopped, them being taken out, and being asked to show their ID, sometimes being taken away, sometimes pushed around, happened all the time. It was kind of the best way to describe it, I think, is daily humiliation. Like, that's what you see, and it's not hidden. I think for some people, maybe you haven't been there, they may kind of think, well, how visible is this? Well, literally in East Jerusalem, it's not hidden area, it's a public space. It wasn't, putting aside what happens in the army or police, these realities were open. I mean, again, a complete culture of impunity. And I think the impact of this, the impact of the recent Gaza, if you want to call it a conflict, war, massacre, whatever word you'd like to use, is actually, on one hand, a shift in public opinion in the US. And what's remarkable to me, having written about this issue now for 15 years, is the shifts that are happening in public opinion within the US in the last few years are quicker and faster and more significant than has happened in the last 20 or 30. Let me give you some examples. So you have in the US, obviously, a Democratic president. I'll get to Biden in a minute. But what you have amongst a lot of American Jews, American liberals, for want of a better word, is a growing support and solidarity with Palestine. That's borne out by the studies, by the polling. It shows growing numbers of Americans are open to BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanction, the idea of sanctioning Israel for its crimes, for its occupation. That was not happening 5 years ago or even 10 years ago. And at the moment, it's true that virtually no senior Democratic political leaders are open to that idea. Joe Biden certainly isn't. Clinton wasn't, of course. No one in leadership was or are. But the grassroots, they are. And this is not, believe me, a defense of the Democratic Party in America. They're a pretty hopeless organization. But I do think that it's significant that many people in the grassroots of that organization, and indeed just in the American public in general, are increasingly open to a different posture between the US and Israel. That is significant. It's far too slow. And it's not helping Palestinians today or tomorrow, but it's significant. I think we should work and build on that. And that, I think, can also play out here. The most recent polling in Australia, which I think was done a few years ago by APAN, sort of, I guess you said, the largest pro-Palestinian lobby group in the country. And I can't remember the exact numbers, so I'm paraphrasing here. Essentially found that there was the majority of people who were polled who understood the situation in Israel and Palestine were far more sympathetic to the Palestinians than the Israelis. That's significant. Now, again, is that reflected in the Liberal Party? Obviously not. The Labor Party, of course not. Parts of the Greens, yes-ish, and definitely in the grassroots with your organization and many others, that's for sure. But I think what you find in a lot of countries is public opinion is radically shifting. And that's not surprising when you realize what's happening there on the ground. And it's hard to hide those crimes. It's hard to hide when you have conflict in Gaza and young people are live streaming or using social media to show what's actually happening on the ground, the killing of families, the bombing of media buildings. Everyone saw those images in the last 6 months. And that impacts public opinion. And what to me is so interesting on one level is that public opinion is shifting in a lot of Western countries, parts of Europe, definitely the UK, parts of the US, parts of Australia. Not because of the mainstream media, but despite the mainstream media. So, yes, there are some reports in the media here which are critical of Israel, and that's to be welcomed. But in general, I would say still, much of the mainstream press here is still relatively supportive or not critical enough of what Israel is doing. The analogy often I make is if you think back to how, and I've looked into this, how a lot of the media in the West covered apartheid South Africa in 1990, which is 4 years before apartheid fell in 1994. And generally, virtually the entire media, and again, there were exceptions, but most of the media, and I'm talking about Australia and beyond, said apartheid South Africa was apartheid. It was terrible. The regime should end. There should be, you know, black emancipation, everything you would hope and expect. This is 4 years before apartheid ended. And there's nothing like that yet here in Australia. I'm not suggesting that Israel will fall in 4 years, but I'm saying that there is still a long way to go. But there is public opinion is shifting despite the fact that so many voices in the media are still supportive of Israel. And I think there's too little conversation here about why that is. And I won't go into it too much detail now. Suffice to say that it's partly because there is, some of you might be aware of this, some not. Although this has probably been put on hold during COVID, but certainly for years, at least 20 years, every year, the Israel lobby here, a number of groups have taken huge numbers of journalists and politicians to Israel on lobby trips. They are being shown a very sanitized version. Of course, they don't go to Gaza. They spend about 5 seconds in Ramallah, which is in the West Bank. They get talked and shown how Israel is a glorious nation, how it's an expert on water, how they're a democracy. And these journalists and politicians pretty much to a person come back and sprout that bullshit, essentially. And breaking that is not so easy. Breaking that that narrative, when I say the narrative is nonsense, but I mean the fact that you have a lot of mainstream journalists and editors, I might add, often never acknowledging that in the work that they do after going to those places, which is unethical, to put it mildly. I know I haven't got that long, so let me just say a few other things. What I think has also changed recently, which is worth reflecting on, is the fall of Netanyahu in Israel, at least for now. I mean, he still wants to come back, but at the moment he's in the opposition, and the rise of Naftali Bennett as prime minister, who's arguably as extreme, if not more so, than Netanyahu. And the reason I mention that is that there has been a really effective sanitizing mission by many in the media about him. Anyone who knows it, and people can Google that, it's very simple to do so. His views, his actions, he used to be in the Israeli military. He's complicit in a number of massacres. In fact, he has admitted to being proud of killing Arabs. Again, it's a horrible quote from a number of years ago. One can Google that if you're curious. But he has to sort of come across somehow as the responsible leader of Israel. And I think what you're finding in many places around the world, particularly, I would say, in the US, where arguably it matters more than anywhere else, the people aren't buying the line. They're not buying this idea anymore, or less so than they used to, that Israel's a thriving democracy, we have to support them no matter what. Look, the Biden administration, to be sure, is going to support Israel no matter what. That's clear. But what's interesting is, I think increasingly, although Israel receives roughly $4 billion US every year of supposed aid, which is partly military support and other kind of financial aid, it's actually far less of the complete Israeli budget anymore. And the impact of that, I think, is quite profound. As Tilly was saying in her introduction, I'm doing a book at the moment, which will be out in about a year and a half, about how the Israeli occupation has gone global. Let me briefly explain what I mean by that, because it's relevant to my point here, that the occupation is now arguably permanent at the West Bank and Gaza. It's not going to end. It's not going to stop. I mean, hopefully it does one day, but for the foreseeable future. And what Israel has done very cleverly from its perspective is it now sells that as an effective marketing tool, meaning that the technology and the methods by which Israel controls Palestinians is now an export. So although for years, as I'm looking into in the book, Israel has partnered and worked with the worst dictatorships in the world, that's been the case since pretty much the 1950s, what you do find in the last 10 or 15 years is a real ramping up of that. So, for example, you may have heard of the recent scandals around NSO. NSO Group is an Israeli spyware company which many countries have bought to essentially control your phone. So if they have your phone number, all they need to do is just have that number, and then your phone can be controlled without you even realizing. It doesn't require you being sent a text or you clicking on some link. It literally only needs to know your phone number. That is the state of play at the moment. That's just one example. But many of the people in those organizations, NSO and others, have worked in the IDF. They've honed their skills in controlling Palestinians, and therefore they are using that as an export. So it's partly a financial sense, but it's also ideological. It's also the belief that says, we've gotten away with this. It's been 53 years. The occupation is not going to end. In fact, if anything, it's getting more entrenched. And we can sell this to countries, and more that you'd be maybe surprised about, find that a very attractive idea of copying in various ways what Israel's been doing. I'll give examples of India and Kashmir, Sri Lanka and elsewhere, where the situation is not exactly the same as Palestine, of course, but it's not dissimilar. And Israel sells both the technology and the tools to repress an unwanted minority or unwanted group, but it's also an ideology. So that's what the next book will be out in, I said, about a year and a half. And I mention that because I think it's important for us to realize when we're trying to tackle, challenge, and really end Israeli apartheid is that increasingly, although US aid for Israel, in fact, is going up, and there are many US politicians who would like it to go up even more, Israel relies less and less on it, meaning that they are finding other ways financially to support themselves. And as I said, the occupation is now an export business. So let me leave it at that maybe, and we can talk about that more later if people like. So thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Anthony. Yeah, that was quite shocking and appalling to hear, but thanks very much for speaking to us. We really appreciate having you here. I'm going to hand over to Caitlin Doyle now.
Thanks, Tilly, and thanks so much, Anthony. It's so useful and valuable to know about those, you know, the details of life on the ground in Palestine and the conditions that people face. And I think, you know, it's undeniable that the ongoing resistance of the Palestinian people in the face of that kind of brutal occupation that you've described, you know, continues and has long inspired oppressed people around the world, as well as kind of putting fear into the hearts of their oppressors in Israel and of leaders across the region, really. And I think that the fact that Gazans have again been protesting at the border with Israel and the march for the right of return recently, you know, just months after the massive assault in April, is an incredible testament to their bravery and resilience. But I think it also demonstrates that Israeli violence doesn't stop when they stop dropping bombs. It's an everyday fact of life for Palestinians. You know, perhaps most acutely in certainly most acutely in Gaza. Just like last week, another young boy, 12-year-old Hassan Abu Al-Nil, was shot dead in the street by an Israeli soldier. You know, it's also the miserable living conditions and poverty that have been imposed by the siege on Gaza, where unemployment is around 43% now, as well as, you know, continued dispossession and exploitation of the massive Palestinians everywhere, which, you know, it has to be said, has been aided by the co-option of the official Palestinian leadership, as Anthony said. But despite the, you know, the horror that Palestinians continue to face, I think there are tentative reasons for some hope, and also certainly opportunities to build solidarity and resistance with the struggle around the world. And as socialists, you know, we need to be constantly looking for ways to forge this kind of solidarity, but with clear eyes about who are the most reliable allies in the struggle for liberation. And that's sort of what I'd like to focus on a bit today. And I think it's, you know, it's encouraging that the response that we saw to the attacks in April and around the world, actually, in terms of the popular response, you know, tens of thousands of people came out into the streets of Sydney, more than we've seen in a long time. Hundreds of thousands rallied around the world in Paris, London, New York, and beyond, calling to free Palestine. And I mean, I think alongside the kind of sheer horror at Israel's attacks, on, you know, one of the most deprived, poor kind of populations on earth, it seemed to me that people also kind of recognized the parallels between the oppression of the Palestinian people and the struggles of the oppressed in the West. You know, I think the massive Black Lives Matter protests that took the world by storm last year are still fresh in people's minds, and the images of Palestinians being shot in the streets bring to mind quite easily images of poor Black men being gunned down every week by cops in the streets of the US, which is, you know, still Israel's biggest backer. And so, while Joe Biden might not be quite as belligerently pro-Zionist as Donald Trump, he's coming to power doesn't mark any real shift in relations at this point. So just to, I guess to go over some background as well. For decades, Israel has been what you could call a watchdog of the West in the Middle East, and has proven itself time and time again. You know, the war with Lebanon against Iraq, Egypt, and so forth in the 20th century to be a reliable tool of Western imperialism and domination of the region and its resources. And it's really the support of the West, and particularly the US, that has allowed Israel to continue to exist for so long and led it to be one of the most heavily armed states in the world. To the extent that the Israeli state could be described as what Anne Alexander calls a military colony, based on the fact that so much of the Israeli state and its resources are geared towards maintaining the military occupation at all costs. And it's one that is ideologically legitimized at every level by anti-Arab racism. And, you know, like successive governments have tried to sort of outdo each other with just how virulent they can be. So since 1945, the country has received around $190 billion in US aid, and that's increasingly taken the form of military aid to ensure it maintains what the US calls a qualitative military edge over neighboring states. Since 1999, they've provided 10-year agreements to ongoing aid, and the most recent of those was signed by Obama in 2016, that committed $38 billion of aid from 2019 onwards. You know, which is not to say that the Israeli state always, you know, does exactly what the US wants. That's not actually the case Certainly not this year. It does strain at the bit, and it goes beyond what the US is willing to put up with sometimes. But generally speaking, it continues to play the role of propping up the West in the region. And for this reason, when Palestinians fight back against the occupation, we stand in unconditional solidarity with them. There's a distinction, I think, between the violence of an oppressive occupying state and the violence and resistance of the oppressed. And I think left-wing anti-imperialist people must always be clear on this, that Israel's violence is not just defensive, despite their claims. And it is encouraging to see the growing numbers of Jewish people around the world coming out in support of Palestine and saying that Israel does not represent them. And another distinction that the left always has to be very clear on is that, you know, Zionism is not Judaism, and we're against anti-Semitism as we are against Islamophobia. But what's also become clearer than ever in recent years is that Palestinian people cannot go it alone. You know, you can't defeat a military machine like Israel with guerrilla warfare. You know, you look at the maps of the shrinking territories of Palestinian territories, and that just becomes clearer and clearer. And it's also obvious that the Arab regimes that have so long claimed to support Palestinian liberation cannot be relied upon to deliver it. In the past three decades, we've seen the logical outcome of the strategy that's been pursued by the Palestinian Liberation Organization and Fatah in one way or another since their founding, an approach that really culminated in the Oslo Accords in 1993, which saw Yasser Arafat essentially accept Israel's occupation of the vast bulk of historic Palestine in exchange for some level of control over the tiny remaining territories of the West Bank and Gaza. And this is why we're seeing the Palestinian Authority, the PA, acting in cooperation with, and you know, even as an extension of the Israeli apparatus to police ordinary Palestinians and quash resistance. And there's been horrifying stories of increased repression and torture being carried out by the PA itself in recent months. Raja Khalidi from the Palestine Economic Policy Research Institute describes the collapse of the PLO into the hands of Israel after the 90s as an almost seamless transition from their pre-Oslo militant stance to the accommodating position towards Israel, global powers, and the lures of neoliberalism. But the seeds of this capitulation, I think, can be found in the nationalist approach of the official Palestinian leadership, which was made up of the wealthier sections of the diaspora from early on. Their approach from the 50s was to rely on support from the Arab regimes like that of Nasser in Egypt, as well as King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, and appeal to them to undertake military action against Israel and help establish a Palestinian state. But this was on the condition of non-interference in the politics of the Arab states. Which effectively often meant backing their leaders against any local uprisings and discouraging the large populations of displaced Palestinians in the region from taking part in those uprisings, even though in many cases they face some of the worst conditions and often repression in the Arab states. But the Palestinian leadership's expectations were unfulfilled. Those Arab regimes were strong on rhetoric, but showed they had no intention of liberating Palestine by military means. The strategy of Fatah from 1965 was to wage a nationalist guerrilla war at home in Palestine, but really try to seal it off from the struggles of the working classes in neighboring states and their more potentially liberatory aims. One of the worst examples of this was in Jordan, where Yasser Arafat denied support to Palestinians organizing a strike against the Jordanian regime, which eventually slaughtered Palestinian activists in their thousands in what was called Black September, and forced many of their organizations to flee to Lebanon, where some of them remain. Again, in 1978, when the Egyptian president Anwar Sadat signed a treaty with Israel, which was brokered by the US, which in effect abandoned the Palestinians, there was huge popular anger both against the leadership and Egypt, the Egyptian regime. The PLO was also marginal to the incredible intifada of 1987. It was largely organized by ordinary Palestinians and had enormous support from the masses of Egypt who organized protests and demanded that the border be open to Israel. And so time and time again, struggles around Palestine have spilled over into broader struggles in the region. And this was certainly the case with the Intifada. And as the solidarity movement spread to places like Turkey, Sudan, Kuwait, Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, and Syria, and inspired popular movements and strikes against their own leaders around local issues, those regimes summoned PLO leaders to help contain its impacts, which in many cases they willingly did. Arafat personally visited Kuwait, praising the regime's support for the Palestinians while condemning local activists. Historian Phil Marshall has said at this time, the solidarity movement had now developed a momentum of its own. Egypt showed what every Arab regime feared, that the Palestine question was among the most subversive in the Middle East. In the act of resisting Zionism, the Palestinians confronted the imperialist control of the region. In the act of solidarity with the Palestinians, Arab students and workers confronted class relations within their own society and the relations which bound their rulers to the world system. I think it was this fact that the rulers of the Arab states were bound to the world system and often economically and politically tied to the West. It was this that made them unwilling to seriously confront Israel and more preoccupied actually with stamping out popular opposition in their own countries. So 50 years of looking to these regimes to establish an independent Palestinian state had really done very little by the 90s when Arafat signed the Oslo Accords, which were praised across the West as a great step forward, but were actually disastrous for the Palestinians and effectively demobilized the liberation movement and has since seen Israel continue to quite aggressively expand. And there's also this abandonment of liberation as an aim by Fatah and the PLO was what saw Gazans vote Hamas into power in 2005 on the basis of their vow to continue to resist Israel, and which then led Israel to impose the blockade that remains today. But while this whole situation is quite dire and has been, particularly since the 90s, as I said, resistance within and beyond its borders has never gone away. And I think the most significant development in terms of the possibilities for Palestine came with the Arab Spring in 2011, 10 years ago this year. With the almighty popular uprisings that we saw across the Middle East, from Libya, Tunisia, Yemen, to Bahrain, Egypt, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, masses of ordinary and working class people rose up against their governments to fight for greater democratic freedoms, an end to political repression, and against the neoliberal turn in the Arab world that has seen millions of people impoverished and a handful of people become mind-bogglingly rich. The kind of anti-imperialism that had given many of the Arab nationalist regimes their support and credibility in the post-war era had given way to the same neoliberalism that has been rolled out in the West since the 1980s, although in many ways it's been much more brutal. State industries that have been privatized, state industries that were the pride and joy of the anti-colonial movements of the 50s and 60s, have been privatized, wages and social spending have been slashed, often as part of IMF structural adjustment programs. And that was certainly the case in Egypt, where I think the most significant of the 2011 revolts happened, where the revolt managed to topple the hated dictator Hosni Mubarak. And that was backed up by workers' strikes across the country. So at that time in Palestine, people came out into the street to celebrate Mubarak's fall. In Amman, apparently Palestinians came out shouting, "Long live Egypt, who's next? Tomorrow, Mahmoud Abbas." And in Cairo's Tahrir Square, people were again demanding that the border with Gaza be opened. So there's an old saying that a lot of people have probably heard that goes, "The road to Jerusalem runs through Cairo," which was also chanted in the street in the streets that year. I think you could also say now that the road runs through Tunis, Benghazi, and Beirut. In every one of these uprisings, a Palestinian flag could be seen, chants for Palestinian liberation could be heard, and the hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians living in these countries also played a significant role in the protests. Palestinian activist Ali Abunima said at the time, "The revolution has reawakened a sense of a common destiny for the Arab world many thought had been lost, that seemed naive when our mothers and fathers told us about it from their youth. The Arab dictators thought their people's spirits were dead too. The revolutions have restored a sense of limitless possibility and a desire that change should spread from country to country." And now, despite having toppled several rulers and won certain concessions in the Arab uprisings, you know, certainly in Egypt initially, Libya and elsewhere, the revolutions that began in 2011 have been pretty decisively defeated for now, in some cases brutally so, as in Egypt and certainly Syria. Palestinian activists have been targeted. Some of our own comrades in our sister organization in Egypt were imprisoned for quite some time. But, you know, the conditions that led to these explosions have not gone away, and nor have the enormous working classes that drove them and that still carry the memories and lessons from these struggles. And most importantly, I think it raised the prospect of a new unity, not just between Palestinians, but the working class of the entire region and the power that they represent. And there's now a much stronger identification of Palestinian interests with those of mass movements in the Arab states than there had been previously. And the struggles that have sprung up since the Arab Spring also, I think, bring new hope for the possibility of change. There's, you know, there has been strikes in Palestine. We've seen strikes on the Iranian oil fields, uprisings in Lebanon and Sudan in 2019, protests in Iraq and so on. I think the issue for Palestinians, Egyptians and others that are determined to bring change is now how to unite these struggles and bring about revolutionary transformation across the region and win real freedom for Palestine. I'm probably pushing time now, and I haven't left myself time to talk about, you know, what we can do here in Australia and in other parts of the world. But hopefully people can bring up those questions in discussion. So I'll leave it there. Thanks.